This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few weeks ago, the writer and activist Brittany Packnett joined us at the law school at the University of Utah for a conversation about equity. It was part of a speaker series, our partnership with United Way of Salt Lake. Packnett co-founded Campaign Zero, which works to end police violence. She was also one of the original organizers of the Black Lives Matter movement. And one of the things she talked about was how these social justice operations have to be different if they're going to make a difference. It's one of the things she noticed after the 2016 election, how many of the demonstrations, like the Women's March in Washington, were, as she put it, efficient, but not sufficient.
I, like, got up on election day, was headed to New York because I was going to be at the Javits Center, baby, when the announcement was made, okay?
Right.
And I went to the airport in St. Louis. I saw all the women, and I was like, hey, girl, today's our day. And got to New York, went to the Javits Center. Everybody's hugging, excited, like, this is it. We finally did it. Glass ceiling is broken. We're going to make it. And then the returns started coming back. We were watching on the Jumbotron, and we were like, that doesn't look quite right, but that's okay. It's early. We're holding out hope. Bubbly's still flowing. People are buying all their, I'm with her t-shirts and whatnot. And then the hour starts coming that I actually have to leave because I told BET that I'd do their late night election coverage. By the time I got to the studio, I sat down next to my friend Simone Sanders, and she was like, I don't think this thing is going to go the way we think it's going to go. If you can imagine being in a room full of black people on national television, airing to audiences and living rooms and kitchens and barbershops and beauty shops and churches full of black people, trying to explain what could have possibly happened on that night, how we are supposed to think about it, what we are supposed to do the next day, and the message that I kept getting in my phone on commercial breaks from my friends who were watching, they kept asking, what are we supposed to tell our kids tomorrow? America decided to remind us of who she has always been. So the question was, how are we going to answer the call? I think in the time since then, we've seen people step up. So one of the ways that people stepped up was the Women's March. But what I was hoping people would get was that this time we had to step up differently than every other time. Because if we kept stepping up the same way we had been stepping up, we'd get the same results. There were women who on election day went and laid wreaths at Susan B. Anthony's grave. I appreciate Susan B. Anthony. I appreciate the progress that she created in this country. But I don't have the same warm and fuzzy feelings because she said, I'd rather cut off this right arm of mine than to fight for the vote for the Negro and not the woman.
Spirit Airlines, flight 112 to Baltimore. Everybody say...
It was a hard day for a lot of marginalized women. I'm walking into a sea of white women who 10 years ago would never have stepped foot into the neighborhood that we were in D.C.
This is an outpouring of energy and true democracy like I have never seen in my very long life.
I've watched the chatter on all of these channels, social media channels, etc., about how people wanted to move the other issues aside.
We've elected an impossible president. We're never going home. We're staying together.
So the disabled women were like, well, what about these accommodations? And folks were like, we don't really have time for that. We got to move quickly.
We're not going to take this lying down. Planned Parenthood is not the problem. We're the solution.
Okay, well, the black women were saying, well, what about these needs, right? The indigenous women were saying, are we going to hear about murdered and missing indigenous women on the stage? Folks were like, well, we got it. Trump is the issue, right? Not that. So we'll get to that next time.
Good did not win this election, but good will win in the end.
We're hearing from trans women who are like, that pink hat actually doesn't speak to me. Can we talk about it? And they're like, you're not really a real woman. So, we'll get to you. It's the same thing.
I am here to tell you we are marching.
I'd rather cut off this right arm of mine than to fight for the vote for the Negro and not the woman. It was the same thing. If we are going to get a different result, our actions, our behavior, our movements have to look and be as equitable as the world we seek to create. It is incumbent upon all of us to recognize, especially as women of all stripes, that oppressing other women doesn't make any of us more free. It makes it harder for us to get free, because unless all of us are free, none of us are free.
Today in the program, our conversation with Brittany Packnett. She's co-host of the podcast Pod Save the People, has a book coming out soon called We Are Like Those Who Dream with One World. And we recorded this conversation live at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. All of Packnett's family, it seems, are activists, but they're also preachers. Her father is a pastor of Central Baptist Church in St. Louis. Her mother is an ordained minister. Her brother went to Yale Divinity School. And Brittany says she was raised in a tradition and an understanding that, as the Bible says, faith without works is dead.
They were always deeply intertwined. So my father is no longer living, but was a Black liberation theologian. So he studied the work of people like James Cone, and I was raised to honor and respect the responsibilities given to us by a table-flipping Jesus, by a Jesus who said, the people are more important than the money, by the Jesus that said, heal people on the Sabbath because people should be healed every day. And when you add to that the power and importance and the centrality of the Black church in the mid-century civil rights movement, in social justice movements across this country, in creating liberatory spaces for Black people in a country that didn't allow us to do anything but worship for so long. I recognize that as a tradition in which I am privileged to do my best to continue. So they've always been intertwined for me. I think that my time in Ferguson helped me double down on my faith from more than just a theoretical standpoint, but really from a personal one. Because when you are staring down the barrel of an armored vehicle and running from tear gas and being met with pepper spray on streets that you have spent your entire life on, there's no one to rely on but God and the community and family that we built in protest.
What was the expectation at home?
There were so many expectations. lots of expectations still. I mean, you're raised by two preachers. You cannot get away with anything.
Yeah.
Church was an expectation, but let's be clear. Church is a broad category. It is an umbrella category. So there was Sunday service. If my dad had to preach somewhere, then we're going to a visiting service somewhere. Sometimes there's a nighttime service because it might be Women's Day or Children's Day or Men's Day, so you've got that. Then there is Bible study midweek. There is choir rehearsal on the weekends. And Sunday school is most certainly expected before church. School certainly was an expectation.
Yeah.
My dad actually went to Yale Divinity School first, and my brother, making my brother a legacy student, which is not a common thing for Black families in the Ivy League. But my dad was one of the first Black accounting majors at Illinois State University. Graduated from there, was the accountant at one of the accountants at the Chicago Urban League, got his call to the ministry, applied to Yale Divinity on a whim, got in, and then they didn't give him any financial aid. So he literally wrote them a letter, and he was like, I grew up on the south side of Chicago, raised by a single mother, and I'm broke. So then they gave him all the money. But all that to say, my parents met at a time when they were both in the middle of their advanced education. My mom was earning her master's degree in social work from the Brown School of Social Work at WashU, which is also my undergraduate alma mater. Yeah. So education was never not going to happen. It was not just expected that we would graduate from high school. It was clearly expected that we would graduate from undergrad and go on to get a graduate degree, which both my brother and I have.
And engagement, activism, was that also the...
I mean, there was really no choice because This is where mom and dad are going today. They're going to the protest, so that's where you're going.
Yeah.
My first protest, I was in a stroller. The first protest I remember helping to organize was, I had to be maybe 8 or 9, and my dad and I were walking around the mall, the St. Louis Galleria, at Christmas time. And I was raised with so many incredible multicultural figures all around me, black ones in particular, because my parents wanted to be sure to instill the things in me that they knew I wasn't going to get in school. So I'm walking around and confused by the idea that all of the Santa Clauses I'm seeing are white. It just never occurred to me that any group of people would be all white, because that was not how I was raised.
Yeah.
So I'm like, yo, Dad, where are the black Santas at, right? And we have a conversation about it. He's like, well, what do you want to do about it? So between his church members, my friends and cousins, there were lots of signs made and placed in people's hands, and some marching around the Santa Claus display in the mall. the news cameras were there, and we got some black Santas in St. Louis. So when I say I was raised in the tradition, I really was raised in the tradition. There was no other option. And I'm grateful, because my dad taught me how to operate in the streets of protest. My mom taught me how to sit at policy tables and in boardrooms and have difficult conversations. And on my best days, I'm the best of the both of them.
You told this story that I love, where your mother and father would take you car shopping. When they would go and talk to the salesman, yeah. Inevitably, this was the 80s, mm-hmm. right? The salesman would always direct his questions to your dad.
Yeah.
Now, what's the gesture your dad would make?
I have to demonstrate. He would sit back like this, and then he'd gesture toward my mother.
Because she was in charge.
She was the chief negotiator in the house. And my mom negotiated the most ridiculous car deals. Like, I was a kid and still knew. I was like, I think you were supposed to pay more than that. I didn't know it at the time, but I was literally watching the practice of defying expectations. That people will express their expectations to you as soon as you step into the room, often non-verbally, and that you have to be centered in yourself enough and confident in your own skill and talent enough to not be shaken by their expectations, but to come forward with your own expectations of yourself. And it was something she didn't even think about in the moment, but she has such a clear command of who she is and what she brings to the table. And I will forever be grateful for seeing that model. I didn't have to look very far for role models, and that's not the case for so many young people.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about Ferguson. And I wonder, I'm not sure if you filtered this at all through faith, but did you see that moment as something akin to fate? Or was it just a circumstance? Did you ever think about it in those terms?
I do think I thought of it in fateful terms in some ways. But those fateful terms had literally nothing to do with me. You know, St. Louis is a city that I love deeply. And when Michael Brown was killed, I was leading a large nonprofit in the region. I had moved home from D.C. And, you know, St. Louis is one of those places that, like, people don't move back to. Josephine Baker used to say St. Louis is a great place to be from. Right. So that was the reputation of our city. And when I moved home for this role, I was very proud of myself. My family was proud of myself. I was a 26-year-old executive director in charge of a large staff, had to raise a lot of money, was serving 20,000 students around the region. And the first Sunday that I went back to my home church after I had moved back, people were like, well, baby, did your boyfriend break up with you? Like, why are you here? Did you get evicted? Are you broke? Or did you lose your job? Because that's the only explanation for why you're here.
Yeah.
And I would look at folks and say, does our city not deserve our investment? Right. Does our city not deserve our attention? So I made the choice to go back home. And 2 years after I had been in that seat, Michael Brown Jr. was killed. And I felt indicted by that. Michael Brown graduated from Normandy High School, which was a school district where our program placed teachers. And the promise that we had made to him about what his education would do for him failed. I wrote a blog piece a couple of days after that. Every time I go back and read it, I realize how viscerally angry I was, justifiably. But I titled it that Michael Brown's diploma wasn't bulletproof. And I realized that for all of the work I was doing and for all of the, you know, cute little 30 under 30 lists I was getting on, because I was still under 30 at that time, that I was getting on, I was not at all proximate enough to my community, to our suffering or our triumph. And that sitting behind a desk every day, even doing a job that is committed to social justice, was never going to be enough. And I had to return to my faith. I had to return to the way I was raised. I had to return to the practice of proximity that I had seen my parents model, and I had gotten away from for a few years. And so, in that way, I believe that, you know, as a Christian woman, I believe that all things work together for the good of those who love the Lord. And so, I believe that that moment helped remind me of my purpose. It helped convict me about my purpose. But I'm also very clear that that moment wasn't about me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whenever people get into this historical argument about who founded this movement, as far as I'm concerned, Michael Brown founded this movement. Sandra Bland founded this movement. Tamir Rice founded this movement. Trayvon Martin founded this movement. The people who are no longer here to sit and have this conversation, those are the folks who founded their movement, and the families who have to wake up every day without them. Those are the founders of this movement, and their sacrifices will forever be greater than the ones that I have had to make. So in certain ways, I am grateful to the people for rising up to remind so many of us of our duty and our responsibility, both personally and collectively. But I am always wise to keep perspective about this thing, because when this thing started, nobody was inviting us to fancy law schools across the country to have conversations on air. They were calling us thugs and other words that I can't repeat on public radio. I just think it's important to stay centered in why we do this.
Did you have a clear strategy in mind at first? I mean, one of the things I've heard you talk about is you wanted to get Ferguson and St. Louis to a point of, I think you put it this way, beloved community.
Yeah.
So what was the strategy? Like, how were you thinking about the steps, if you were, of getting there?
And I'm going to use a lot of we's here, because there were lots of late night planning meetings, lots of organizing conversations, yeah. Lots of people who were there all the time pushing forth the best ideas, working through the difficult things. I would say, especially in those first 400 days, part of it actually was that we didn't have to strategize because the police kept giving us a reason to come outside. There were six more young black men who were killed by St. Louis police, both in St. Louis County, where Ferguson is, and across St. Louis City, over the next 6 months, actually to a year. There was a young man named Mansour Balbay who was killed two blocks from my church, almost a year to the day after Michael Brown was killed. And the police literally came back with stronger tear gas. Some of it wasn't strategic at all. Some of it was
reaction,
simply out of necessity. Yeah. Exactly. We had to keep coming outside because the police kept killing us. But the backdrop, especially of those early 200 days, was to do what Dr. King talked about in the letter from a Birmingham jail, was to create the crisis that would force power structures to move. And I will say that that letter was really central for me during that time, because I found myself sadly surprised, confronted with people that I did not think were going to show up as the white moderate, but they did. Hmm. And I want to be clear that all of those people who showed up as moderates were not white in that moment, unfortunately. People who were more concerned about keeping order than actually creating justice. And so we realized that in that moment, we had to shock some people into realizing this is all of our problem. So a lot of our strategies had to do with disrupting the status quo, disrupting the existing order of things.
You talked about the element of surprise.
The element of surprise was deeply important. There would be nights that we would tweet out where we were going to be, and that was a misdirection for the police, and the greatest nights were when the protests would literally walk by where the police were, where they thought we were going to go, and we'd walk to the actual spot. There was so much creativity on the streets. My favorite protest was a time when there was a street shutdown that was based on a chant we used to say. We used to say a chant, "They think it's a game, they think it's a joke." And that was because when the police would be in their skirmish line, fully uniformed with batons and in full riot gear, some of them would laugh at us while we were protesting. So we started to chant, "They think it's a game, they think it's a joke." We knew our freedom wasn't a game, but we wanted them to know. So my friend Kayla, who is one of the most brilliant organizers I've ever met, she was like, it was one of those movie moments. She was like, they think it's a game. They think it's a game. They think it's a game. Aha. She sent everybody off home to go and get jacks and sidewalk chalk and jump ropes. And people were literally shutting down the street by playing games. And there's this image of these black teenagers teaching this white grandmother how to double dutch. I mean, just think about it, right? And they're shutting down the street doing an intergenerational, multicultural double dutch.
Right.
That you couldn't have seen had the kind of creativity and love and joy that we tried to inject into everything we do not been there. And so the strategy was about trying to live fully while disrupting a status quo that didn't want us to do that.
Brittany Packnett. She's co-host of the podcast Pod Save the People, also a leader in the Black Lives Matter movement. She joined us on stage last month at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hey, it's Lee Hale, host of the Preach Podcast. On our latest episode, Jeannie Gaffigan, on how a pear-sized brain tumor tested her faith.
You've got to get your kids into heaven. You've got to get yourself into heaven. And then the minute that we're like, you might die, we're like, but I don't believe in heaven.
That's comedy writer and producer Jeannie Gaffigan on Preach. Find Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation with the writer and activist Brittany Packnett. This was part of a speaker series on the question of equity, and we partnered with United Way of Salt Lake. Packnett called social justice her ministry. We recorded this live at the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah.
You talked about what happened to Eric Garner and Tamir Rice and Michael Brown was a failure of systems. Mm-hmm. Systemic oppression and racism. What's at the heart of that failure? Because the thing that I'm trying to figure out is, like, is it inherent in human nature that we're so tribal we're going to oppress others? Mm-hmm. Or is this something that we can move past? We just have to get it out of our system somehow.
I am a hopeful person. A lot of it comes from my faith. I believe that a beloved community is possible. So I don't think that it is simply that human nature is tribal and we're always going to be a little bit like this. When we co-founded Campaign Zero coming out of the Ferguson uprising, we called it Campaign Zero because we believe that we can live in a world where the police don't kill people. And that is... that is, for some people, a deeply radical idea. And there are lots of people who are like, well, no, the police are always going to kill somebody. No. They don't actually have to. And we have to be daring enough to have liberatory imagination. We can look at other developed nations where the police officers only carry things that are less than lethal. We can look at places like Japan and the UK that have little to no police-involved killings at all. It is totally possible, right? This is the same kind of attitude that folks have about gun control, right? But we saw Australia change the game. New Zealand, rather, they made a completely different decision. And so we have to be willing to imagine in that way, and I am. So I don't believe that things will always be this way just because they've been this way for my lifetime. That said, if systems were created by people, then we have the power not only to tear down the existing systems, but to actually build different things in their place.
Yeah.
And that is the thing I think people forget or try to ignore, because that is the hard part. Trying to build the plane as you fly is very difficult. We love the battle. We like to get out there and scream and yell, but we forget the building.
So we have to be able to talk about this stuff,
yeah,
process it, be willing to be accountable, those who are part of the system, say you're sorry, make reparations, whatever it might be. That's part of the process that
all
you're thinking
of it.
About. Yeah.
Truth and reconciliation.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, when we look at post-apartheid South Africa, which still has a great amount of challenges, right? But coming out of that space required truth and reconciliation. The current occupant of the White House used the word lynching to describe Congress trying to hold him accountable. Congress, which is the duly elected legislative body that the Constitution not only allows but mandates that it holds the executive branch accountable, right? And that it provides a check and a balance. Congress is not a mob. Mobs lynch. Congress investigates, right? And I watched people bend over backwards yesterday to defend the use of this word, despite its absolutely disgusting history in this country. And I'm sitting here going, I don't understand how you can really fix your mouth to do, like, why is this how you're spending your time? And I realized it's because we're not willing to tell the truth. If we were willing to tell the truth about the history of lynching in this country, nobody would be using that word cavalierly. This is why Bryan Stevenson has built the lynching memorial in Montgomery, Alabama. That's the truth part. We are so afraid of the truth because so often it implicates and indicts us, and we'd much rather preserve our comfort. Just like Michael Brown's death implicated and indicted me, there are moments happening around us all the time that we have to be willing to look in the mirror and say, this moment convicts me too. This is not just about them and they over there. This is not just about somebody marching in Charlottesville with, you know, a tiki torch, right? This is actually about me, the systems I participate in, the systems I benefit from, the stereotypes that I promote, the institutions that I help support that are not equitable for people. And until I recognize my own participation in that system, until I'm willing to tell myself that truth and therefore tell other people that truth, we can't get to a reconciliation that will actually last.
So forgiveness can come, but it has to come after accountability and truth.
Yeah. Precisely.
Yeah.
I tell people that my grace extends as far as your responsibility is willing to meet it. I am trying to be like Christ. I am not Christ. My grace is not sufficient, nor is it everlasting. Human beings have to recognize that the extension of forgiveness requires action on the part of the other person. This is the conversation that was happening around the trial of Amber Guyger, if y'all remember this. Amber Guyger killed, was a police officer who killed Botham Jean while he was sitting and eating ice cream in his Dallas apartment. And the conversation that was happening in the Black community, if you are not aware, after that trial was a conversation about how often America expects forgiveness from Black people after we have endured a great deal of trauma. Hmm. So we saw Botham's brother offer forgiveness and a hug to the ex-officer. And I am not at all here to judge that choice because I did not lose my brother in the way that he did. But the judge, an officer of the court, also extended a hug to Amber Guyger. And I asked my pastor about it because I was like, maybe you need to pray for me. Like, maybe I just do not have the right forgiveness gene and somebody needs to lay hands on my broken heart. Because I couldn't understand the extension. And I try so hard to be a loving person, but I could not understand this moment. And it was because I hadn't seen Amber Guyger take any real responsibility. We had watched video of her on the witness stand continuously excusing her actions, defending her actions, continuously saying, I thought it was my apartment, et cetera. And irrespective of what you think of the case, there was not a clear acknowledgement of this was my behavior. This is what I did to cause this, right? Here's the harm that I caused. Here's the system that I have been a part of that has allowed people like me to extend this kind of harm to people over and over and over again. And as somebody who aspires toward prison abolition, I actually don't want to see a bunch more people go to jail, even people that I'm very deeply hurt by. But without that real sense of accountability and responsibility, We cannot demand people's forgiveness because what that allows us to do is actually abdicate ourselves of that responsibility. And then we move on and we cause the harm all over again because nobody's held us accountable. Mm-hmm. We're seeing that every single day in America. Forgiveness can absolutely be extended, but one has to take responsibility and provide reconciliation for the harm they caused.
You said this thing I wanted to ask you about that I'm fascinated by, and it's you've talked about how we have to have this conversation that goes beyond the conventional idea of what power is,
mm-hmm.
And redefine power. So I wanted to, and this is the thing you said. You said a lot of us, we kind of think about power as this, like a commodity.
Yeah.
Like it's like oil, I think is mm-hmm. how you put it.
Yeah.
But you say power is something more abstract. It's more like air.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
So the fundamental challenges in our country, challenges of oppression and systemic injustice, are centered in the fact that certain people have power and they want to hoard it, period. Which means that sharing your power is seen as a threat to you, right? Mm-hmm. If you share your power, you see it as a loss to yourself. Instead of recognizing that actually you being able to live in your full abundance doesn't take anything away from me. Interestingly, there's this whole controversy happening right now about always feminine products. There apparently used to be a symbol on the package of the Venus symbol, which is supposed to represent women. I am almost 35 years old. I've been a woman my whole life. I never saw that symbol, ever. And all of a sudden when they take it off because they're trying to be more inclusive of trans men and gender nonconforming people who also menstruate, people got very upset. And I was like, what are you losing by the packaging changing in order to include people who were already buying those products? What are you losing? Yeah. You are losing none of your power. You are losing none of your ability to live fully. You are losing none of your ability to live in abundance. And yet people were saying, I'm being erased. I'm losing something, right? That's not actually a loss. We just treat it like it's a loss because that's the dominant culture that we've ingested. So I think if we move to a place where we think about power more like air, we can actually understand how to share it. Everybody in this room is breathing air and there's still enough for all of us. There could be another 500 people to walk in this room and there'd still be enough air for all of us. And so operating in abundance instead of scarcity moves us to the place where we can share power without seeing it as a threat or a loss to ourselves.
So pay equity often comes up in this conversation of equality and equity. And I wanted to ask you about this, but one thing we should point out is a lot of the times the way this argument plays out is with women at the top of the pay scale. And often women of color aren't taken into account.
Yeah.
White women make 80 cents for a dollar made by a man. But black women make 65 cents. Latina women make 58 cents. And it just gets worse for other women of color.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about this, because you've talked about it as the disparity is, this is how you put it, is not just a failure of morality, it's a failure of efficacy.
So like you said, if you were to continue that chart, indigenous women are making even less. People like to point out an erroneously understood statistic that Asian American Pacific Islander women supposedly make more than white women. But what is actually true is if you disaggregate the data among Asian American Pacific Islander folks, East Asian people are making far different wages than South Asian people. And so, you know, some folks get tired of this conversation because they're like, well, you could keep breaking this thing down and breaking this thing down and breaking this thing down. And where does it stop? And I'm like, well, it stops when everybody gets equal pay. but there is a business case to this.
Yeah.
And as somebody who has had to raise a lot of money in a city about an altruistic thing, right, being educational equity, I have come to understand that you have to adapt the message for your audience. And so some folks need to understand that the business case, right, the case of efficacy around equal pay is the exact reason why I gave a TED Talk on confidence. And people were like, that's a soft topic. And I'm like, no, it's really not, because you want your best supported, most confident, most ready people at the table with you, ready to make decisions. You don't want folks who are dealing with the additional cognitive burden that inequity puts on you when they're sitting at that decision-making table. So we can say that having diversity at the table makes us all better, but if those diverse people are not included in the space, right, then it makes it harder for those diverse people to perform at their top level. And then if those folks are included, but they are not experiencing equitable outcomes, their promotions are different, their pay is different, their opportunities are different, you're then adding on to that burden. And so the business case for this is you're literally not getting the best out of your people when you treat them this way. And I would think that we all want the best outcomes in private and public industry. So it is not just a moral failing that we continuously do this. It is a failing of efficacy. The cure for cancer, right? The next critical invention, the cure for the climate crisis could be sitting in the brain of someone who has all of those additional cognitive burdens on them, and the brilliance can't get out. And I just think it would be a shame for all of us, a shame on all of us, if we allowed that kind of brilliance to go unheard simply because we are unwilling to figure out how to make sure everybody gets what they earn and what they deserve.
All these norms are being destroyed.
You were trying to figure out how to say that.
I'm trying to figure out how to say it. But one of the things you've talked about is that this disorientation, all this kind of craziness, this confusion is purposeful.
Oh, absolutely.
Like to get people distracted. Say more about that.
The distraction, the disorientation, the constant barrage of things to be upset about is designed to tire all of us out. And if they can tire us out, then they can wait us out. And if you can wait us out, then you can do whatever you want to do. It feels like it's never ending. And when we do Pod Save the People, we try our best not to do a bunch of White House-centric news. We feel like across the network we're on, people are getting a lot of that information. Across mainstream media, people are getting a lot of that information. So we're trying to make sure that we amplify and spotlight the smaller things that are not getting a lot of attention. But it becomes really difficult to do that because there is so much coming from here. And we also feel very responsible to give people a lens on the mainstream news that they're not necessarily seeing. So you might see the news coming out of the Justice Department, and you need to know how that is going to affect people of color. You need to know how that's going to affect people living in low-income circumstances. You need to know how that's going to affect rural voters, right? So these are the kinds of things that we try to do. And being a curator and deliverer of that news and analysis can be really exhausting for me, so I know it's exhausting for the listener. And I'm just really clear that that is by design. And so I think that in this moment, it is going to sound antithetical, but as vigilant as we remain, and we have to, as clear-eyed as we stay, and we have to, as committed as we are, and we have to be, we also have to remember that deciding to live in our fullness and our authenticity is a form of resistance. That deciding to intentionally pursue joy when what is happening right now is designed to make you feel anything but joyful is an act of resistance. I got married, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before. And thank you. It was the most incredible day. I didn't even know it could be. And I keep hearing from folks just grateful for the amount of joy that was in the space. And I feel like we said our vows, everybody said the right name, so we did our job in that way.
Right.
But I also feel like we did our job because we gave the people we love some kind of respite from everything that's happening out there. And everything that's happening out there isn't even just coming from the White House, right? We have to recognize that when this administration is over, injustice will still exist because Trump is the symptom. He's not the virus. So there's still educational inequity to combat. And I'm grateful for the work that the United Way is doing here in actually addressing educational equity, right? And not just how to help people cut their next check, right? Like there's more work to be done there. But we will still face racism. We will still face systemic oppression. There is still so much work to be done. And if we allow it to overwhelm us, we're never going to be the people who we were meant to be to stand up and fight it.
There's a story that I've heard you tell about this book you were attracted to when you were a kid. And it had this powerful photograph of Septima Clark.
Yes.
And she, I want you to describe this, this portrait, because you've talked about that, it was the portrait itself, like her profile, that had more impact on you than maybe what was even in the book.
It's so funny, because every time I start describing this book, anybody black born between like 75 and 95 knows which book I'm talking about before I say the name, and they can picture where it was on their mom's living room table. So Septima Clark, for those who don't know, was an educator and activist. She essentially educated the civil rights movement, right? So she built schools across the South and in classrooms essentially taught people the practices of disciplined civil disobedience, taught folks their correct history, et cetera. So people like Rosa Parks and other folks come out of that scholarship, come out of that space. So she was an activist and an educator before the title was a thing, before I knew what it was. And as she aged, there are all these beautiful portraits that were taken of her, but there is one in particular where she's not adorned at all. She's sitting in profile, and, you know, her hair has gotten sparse because she's quite elderly in this picture. It is, a salt and pepper, more salt than pepper. And she's got these plaits, these braids coming down the side of her head. And she's sitting in profile, and her face is looking toward the sky, and her head is kind of resting on her chin. And the book is called I Dream a World. And in the book, there are all of these black and white portraits of these incredible black women throughout history. And these were the kind of books that I was looking at as a child. But there was so much dignity and clarity on her face that I used to literally sneak into the living room to see this book. And I had to sneak because the furniture and the carpet was white. Living room was for company. The living room was not for the kids with their dirty hands and dirty shoes. So I would like take off my shoes really quietly and set them by my mom's curio, and I would tiptoe into the room because I know if I got caught in the room, I'd be like, why are you in the living room? You should be downstairs with your brother. That's where the kids go. But I would go and I would just stare at this book. And there's something so powerful about recognizing the responsibility that your ancestors place on you, whether you've ever met them or not. And I met Septima Clark through that photograph. Yeah. And as we've lost so many people, Diane Carroll and Toni Morrison, I'm always reminded that our elders become our ancestors to remind us to be free. And that photograph helped me learn how to be free before I could articulate it. Yeah.
I think there's a central theme I think I've identified in your work so far.
I'm very curious to what it is because I don't know.
Well, here's what I think it is. I think it is, and this is how you've described it, it's the intersection of the political and the personal.
Yeah.
So I wanted you to talk a little bit about this because you've said that you cannot do this kind of work without personally examining your own place in these systems and the effect they've had on you. And what, telling the story as well? Like you've got to do that first before you can do that work?
I mean, you've got to tell it at least to yourself so that you can be fully equipped. This idea that the personal is always political comes from black feminist collectives because marginalized people may not have all the data, they may not have all the jargon, they may not have all the language, but they can tell you the reality of the worst of what a country is offering, always. Dominant culture has taught us that only numbers and graphs count, but lived experience counts too. And there are folks who existed in that tradition who gave us the understanding that the personal is political, and the political is always personal. So I don't think I've ever thought about it any other way, to be honest. But what that also means for our personal responsibility is to recognize the smog that we've breathed in. I always say that dominant culture is a smog, so we all breathe it in. Right. And there are ways in which, I mean, I use this example a lot, but my hair changes all the time, all the time. The poster, I'm in short hair. I'm clearly not today. My hair was dark in that picture. It's not today. But I also know that I have ingested certain messages about the hair that grows naturally out of my head. I have internalized the idea that it is unprofessional. that it is that my kinks are too tight to ever be neat, that it is not attractive. And undoing the internalized racism from my hair alone is still a journey that I'm on. And I'm almost 35 years old. So then if you add all of the things I've internalized about the rest of my body as a black woman, the rest of my ability as a black woman, right? If you think about all the things, all of the messages that I have internalized from media, from peers, from educators, about who I am and what I am capable of, that is a lifetime of work to undo. And so often in our diversity and inclusion spaces, the only work that we allow people to do is for people who hold power and privilege to start to confront themselves. And we never give space to the folks who have internalized the other side of that power and privilege to do the work they need to do. Yeah. That in and of itself is the perpetuation of a racist system. Because even as you're trying to undo racist systems, you give white men all the space to do their work and you tell everybody else, figure it out on your own. That doesn't work. And undoing the internalized oppression that I have ingested is a journey that, like, is difficult to be on, and it is taxing and it is exhausting, and there's so many days that it would just be easier to keep on breathing in the smog. And I have to recognize that even though it is not my fault that I have gotten these messages and internalized them, now that I know better, I have to do better, and it is my responsibility to undo it. So that is work I have to do if I expect to be effective on a protest line, if I expect to be effective on an Obama task force around policing, if I expect to be effective in this conversation. If I lack that kind of self-awareness, there is only so much truth that I'm able to speak.
When was the first time you heard Dr. King's reference to love and power?
Oh, so like a true millennial, I express a lot of my emotions with emojis. And true story, I found myself kind of signing off my Facebook rants, which turned into Instagram caption rants, which turned into Twitter threads. I found myself signing off with two emojis, a heart emoji and a fist emoji. And in my head, I was thinking love and power. Like, I felt like that was the quickest way to communicate my personal philosophy about social change. In the idea that we should not be afraid of power, we should not be afraid of our own power, we should not be afraid to exert power in ways that are loving, in ways that are informed by love. And I was like, wow, Brittany, you are so brilliant. And then I realized Dr. King had the idea first, which means somebody probably had it before him. But I first encountered that I was reading his autobiography, which is really just a collection of his speeches and writings. And he started to talk about this idea of love and power and how we so often in society divorce them from each other and treat them like opposites. But in fact, that they are more powerful together. So he says that on its own, love is sentimental and anemic. People really hate to hear that. Why? Because we've been taught that all we have to do to end injustice, systemic racism and oppression is to just love each other a little bit more. Just talk to each other a little bit more, right? Like, if the police just go play basketball with the kids in the neighborhood, everything will be fine. Hasn't worked so far. So clearly, love on its own, the way that we have defined it, in this sentimental and anemic way that Dr. King talks about, is not and has not been enough. What he also says, though, is that power on its own is reckless. And I don't think I have to explain that to you all. We've seen plenty of reckless power in our day. So then he asks the essential question of what can the two do together? If we use our power and have it be informed by love, what are we capable of accomplishing? I do not want marginalized people to be afraid of power. I do not want us to treat power like it is a dirty word. I want us to seek power. I want us to demand power. I want us to want power. I want us to recognize and own our own power. And I want us to inform it with love always.
Brittany Packnett. We spoke with her last month at the S.J. Quinney College of Law on the campus of the University of Utah. This was the final conversation about equity in our speaker series with United Way of Salt Lake. Radio West is a production of KUER. Our thanks to Bill Krim and Ashley Razan and the rest of the team at United Way of Salt Lake. Our intern, Natu Twe, produced this episode. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.